process we'll be using today is twofold. One, I will be providing input and some challenges along the way. I'm going to start off by making a few comments about work, vocation, and faith. And then I'm going to invite you to wrestle with a couple of questions. Those are only start-off questions, and we'll be using a process called dialogue. But the start-off questions are, have you drank the Kool-Aid, and is it any good? And the second one is, what is it, or where do you fit between these particular two notions on a continuum? Merchant mentalities and service mentalities, and I'll even take it a little further, servant mentalities. So we also will be introducing other questions. This is a two sort of back-to-back session. You're welcome to stay for as long as you want. Just say goodbye to us when you leave. I won't take it as a sign that you're not interested. You just may want to go see my colleagues thing next door in an hour. So, because we have some back-to-back things going on. That's how we're going to do it, and I'm going to explain what dialogue is. There have been some people who've been in a couple of my sessions, and they may be able to help. You'll get a chance to try this in this session, and then later on in our week here at Holden, the whole community will engage in the dialogue process. When I started thinking about this issue of vocation and work, it was really triggered by some things that were going on in industry. In the last 3 years, nearly 1 million people have lost their jobs. Since 1985, I don't even know the total number, but it's well over about 25 million people have lost their jobs, been downsized or forced to move on. Just in the period from the time President Clinton took office up till now, we've had enormous, what I call, shifting in people's jobs. How many of you know at least one person who's lost their job in the last 2 years? Okay? Yes. How many of you lost your job in the last 2 years?
Four years.
Well, somewhere in the last 5 years, most of you probably made a shift. The reason I began to think about this is that I was the vice president of Pillsbury. And one of my jobs was to be involved with those decisions that had to do with where we close plants, who do we let go of, and who do we keep. My moment of what I call crisis came when I was asked to prepare severance packages for about 50 people. Of the 50 people, about 40 of them were white men, and the rest of the group were a range of people of difference. Frankly, I think there were only two women in the piece, but they were all white men who had worked for Pillsbury in excess of 30 years. Yes. Many of them were 2 and 3 years away from retirement. And oh, by the way, the package did not offer a bridge. Yes. Now,
you mean no retirement at all?
No. What happens is you get vested and you have retirement, but there are significant financial impacts if you don't bridge the person until the cutoff time. In fact, part of the contract is that you stay and do your job, and if you stay for these years, you get these goodies. Our decision at that point was that we were going to cut you off from those goodies. It was the company, not you. And when those folks signed up 35 years ago, you obviously know we had a different set of rules. I had all the packages. I'll never forget this. I had the packages home on my dining room table. I was married at the time, and I could not go to sleep because the next day I was going to be seeing these people one after another every 30 minutes. I had no problem with a couple people who had not been there that long, but the majority of the people were going to be pretty tough, particularly because most of them had no other life. Their life was their job. I knew it. We had psychiatrists ready. We knew that this was going to not be pleasant. And we were going to do it on a Tuesday, so that from Tuesday to Friday you could do support, and they needed to be moved out of their offices and out of Pillsbury by Friday at noon after 35 years.
Did they have any idea?
Absolutely not. Companies have a real good way of keeping things secret because they had no idea. One person I knew was on vacation and was going to get called on the phone. Mm-hmm. On vacation. So I started to think about both, why am I doing this and how did I get here? You know, I just want to be a nice person. And why am I ending up being the person that's having to deliver this news? Because I did not make the decision. It was my job to do that. It's one of them. But in that crisis, I made a couple decisions, that one that I would have to quit the company because I could not do it and I wasn't going to do it. So I called the president of Green Giant, which was a part of Pillsbury, and said to him, as a Christian, you're asking me to do something I absolutely cannot do. You're asking me to destroy people's lives. I said, I won't do it. I said, get somebody else to do it. And if that means I need to resign, I'll have my resignation on your desk tomorrow morning. I cannot do this. What happened was, that triggered him I must have called on something inside him. Because he was a born-again Christian and pretty open about it. And so I just sort of nailed him at that place. I kept coming back. There were three phone calls, so I made a phone call, I hung up, he called me back, we hung up, he called me back again. There was a emergency management meeting called for 7 o'clock the next morning. We were all there. I told them that in good conscience I felt like we could not do this, both as a company and frankly from my point of view as a faith, they were asking me to do something I couldn't support. What happened is, people did get packages, but they got them 2 weeks late. What we did is we did do the bridge, the financial bridge, so that people could retire. That was the best that I could do. But it put me into a place of really beginning to think about, do I want to be sitting here 32 years from now and have some other person who may not have thought about it show up and tell me, oh, by the way, you're out of here. So I had two things. Do I want to be that loyal, which is, have you drank the Kool-Aid and how does it feel? that's what you do. You drink the Kool-Aid and you say, these are the commitments I'm going to make. This is at the end. I can retire. I call it, for those of you from Minnesota, the cabin and Brainerd phenomenon. The cabin becomes the icon in your life that you are moving toward. And what's unfortunate is that many people never make it to the cabin in Brainerd. And so I began to think about, if this is going to happen to these nice old white men who I kind of like, you know, after, you know, dreaming up the whole notion of the Jolly Green Giant, you're going to kick out, we kicked the man out who dreamed it up. Ho, ho, ho. I mean, it was amazing. But in my thinking about it, I kept saying, so, this really is a job. And at any moment, the circumstances can change, and I can be without a job. So why should I be loyal to Pillsbury? Because I can bet you that Pillsbury, when they get in a tight, will let me go. Now you have to understand that 2 weeks before this happened, I had the joy of putting the package together for getting rid of the CEO. That was a very different package. Sort of $10 million just to make you feel good. They have to say this person nearly ruined the company because of his poor leadership. But because of the way that we have set it up in our economy, this man got $10 million for screwing up. In addition to stock, an office and a secretary for the rest of his life. And he was 54 years old. So you can imagine what that might do to one's faith as you begin to see these kinds of things happen. So I began to think about, obviously, work is an exchange for some kind of monetary gain. You do some task and you get paid for it. And do I want to dedicate my life to something that is so nebulous that at the end of it, I may end up with nothing and they walk away with it all? Or at best bet, the person who ruined it for me walks away 10 times a millionaire. It's funny because this person lives in my neighborhood. I have to go by his house every day. I can't get out of the neighborhood. So every day I'm reminded that we wrote this man a $10 million check for screwing up a company. We laid off 23,000 people. Of that 23,000, some percentage had mortgages. Some percentage had commitments. A lot of those people had families. And we ruined some lives. So, there has to be some kind of faith response to all of this. And I landed in a couple of places, if you care for me to share that with you. The places I landed were that there's a thing called work, and there's a thing called vocation. And I define vocation as, what are you being called to do? What is God asking you? How is God asking you to show up in the world? And what is that? And sometimes what we do is we make decisions to diminish this calling based on the financial outcomes over here. This is solid and rooted. This is very temporal. Now, the drinking the Kool-Aid part is, many of us were convinced that that just wasn't so. That if we played the rules and drank the Kool-Aid, what would happen? What? We'd go to at least hog heaven. In terms of retiring with a pension, etc. Our parents in many ways didn't have to deal with that, but we have to deal with that. And what's really interesting is that nearly everyone, and some studies are coming out, most people tend to do, if they have strong faith, tend to do well in what we call the transition onto something else. Particularly if they don't have a lot tied into materialism. If you're a person that needs to sustain a certain kind of wealth, or what we call things of wealth, then that those are the people that usually jump out of windows or sometimes show up and blow people away. Does it ever cross your mind why people come back and kill people?
Not so unreasonable now, is it?
What?
It's not so unreasonable now.
It's absolutely not unreasonable because most people, again, have tied all of their life into work. Tom Peters, do you know who Tom Peters is? He's a person who writes, a consultant. He'd be a great preacher because he tends to sweat a lot when he's talking. And I always think, boy, if we kind of put him in the gospel, he might really liven some people up. But Tom Peters talks about the five F's, and I'll share those with you because I think that those are apropos to our discussion, because I think they describe the situation regarding work. The five F's are, and fickle,
fast, fluid, future, and the one I like, festive.
In the world of work, things have sort of moved along at a very sort of organized pace. I like to think of places like IBM. Things are buttoned up, they're crisp, they move, there's no craziness. IBM has been a client for about 5 years, and I've been with them through this craziness, their own sort of coming to light and having to face letting people go and giving people packages. Oh, by the way, they did superbly better than a lot of places. But what I want to say is the venue that we're swimming in is much more like the description that Tom Peters has come up with. First of all, the customers or what people buy, they're becoming much more fickle. So 1 week they're going to want strawberry ice cream, and the next week someone says strawberries will cause you to have lactose back up in your bowels, and suddenly it's not going to work. I love the response when people said, popcorn at the theater would kill you. People said, well, I got to die of something. Now, it's true. And I remember my mother saying to me, oh, Lord, have mercy. What are they going to say next? But the market is fickle. So at any moment, you can go from something working really well to something not working so well. We had a product at Pillsbury, Poppin' Fresh, and that came on the market just as, what? Pop-Tarts?
Yeah, yeah. Dave Barry's Pop-Tarts.
Yeah,
yeah. Was it set up the toaster on fire?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we had that problem. But oh, by the way, we thought this would be a great breakfast food for kids with about, you know, 99.7% sugar. So they came out just at the point when people were saying sugar is bad for children, and guess what our product did? In fact, what we did is we basically sold the product in Brazil because they still like sugar down there. This also moves on to something I call fast. If you even think about the personal computer and its introduction and where we are today and what's coming, I bought a PowerBook, and I bought the top-of-the-line PowerBook in the first set of products from the folks at Apple. My product is obsolete. They're not even remaking the product, and my computer's not even 3 years old. No, they're making software for it, but in terms of being able to get the same kind of equipment, absolutely not. So we're living in a very, what I call, fast-paced situation. Now, I always think of the notion of those dogs in the back of the cars from the 50s that their heads kind of, you know, well, those heads, instead of going like this, are spinning. And they're going to come up. So this train is moving quite fast. When I say fluid, that means things are going in different directions and sometimes running into each other. And we have fluid markets, and our markets are driven by the economy. There are at least six significant pools of capitalistic markets in the world. And trust me, Japan does not look at capitalism the way we do. Neither does Brazil or France or the UK. And if you've got time, you may want to read a book I'm going to recommend, The Seven Cultures of Capitalism. And you will truly understand that both the acting out of capitalism and the values that drive it look very different depending on where you are in the world. Those are fluid and are colliding. So what happens is what gets controlled becomes more and more difficult. Because you may be sitting in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, working at a sausage factory, and something happens in a market in France, and you don't think it has anything to do with you, and it's like a ripple on a pond, and sooner or later it may get to you, because we live in a system that is influenced. The future also is something that we have to be thinking about in terms of what is the future, in terms of what we predict, but more importantly, what is the future that you prefer? Do we want to continue to live in a future that's bound by some notion of what I call the Lord of Abundance, and continuing to sort of acquire wealth at any cost, even the cost of working two jobs with four jobs among two people in one family? How many of you know that folks are basically, they spend the time working? Both folks. Sunday becomes a day when they can, if they're not working on Sunday, are collapsing. To sustain a livelihood that is some kind of picture, whether or not that's right or wrong, but they're giving it all to that. So what is the future you prefer? And most people say their notion of the future is, I'm going to be tired and exhausted. And I would hope that you could think about creating a better picture. The next one is Think Festival. And it's almost like you could either say, well, this is really doomsday. You know, we're really doomed here. Actually, it's like a fiesta. The world has become like one gigantic carnival. And that's where I got the notion of my title, Vineyards of Possibility. I love that piece in the Lutheran literature where we say, let the vineyards be fruitful. Well, if we don't have a sense of new possibilities and we don't have a sense of vocation, they won't be fruitful. If we continue to attach ourselves onto work as the place where we go, then I think we will get ourselves in deep trouble. Now, another way of responding regarding work to the five F's is over here, where I have stated that under work, look at work as a series of projects. And as Luther said, the highest task is your daily task that day. Now, the mentality around life as a series of projects, when you really look back on your careers, even if I would even suggest all of you sitting here in the room, you've been less bound by a job and more bound by what did you do. And there are enormous new ways in which both companies and small enterprises are organizing in order to sustain this. And the only glitch, one of the major glitches we have, is retirement and benefits for healthcare. If we can figure out the benefits for healthcare in terms of being more fluid, then we'll be well on our way here. 3M is a great client. They have a system there that you don't get a job there unless you started there when you were two. So if they want talent from the outside, they contract. So I have contracts with 3M. They treat me very well. I told this story last week. The state of Minnesota is offering me a contract, and guess what the clinch is? Because they can't pay me a lot of money, because in Minnesota you can't make more than the governor. He doesn't make a lot of money. Which is why we can't recruit some top peak talent, because the governor does not pay that well. But they have figured out that there are lots of people like me out there, and they've got something to trade, and that is healthcare. So for so many hours a month, if I agree to consult or be a consultant on projects, they will pay my healthcare full for me and Katie. Now that means two things. One is their system is better than the one I have. Number two, I'm going to save about $600 a month. So I'm going to take the contract, because then my health care gets covered, and the project's interesting. They sold me on the project, not on how much I'm going to get paid. I can make that up with another client. That's a tough way to work, but that's the way most of us are going to be working, I believe, in the future, even in the church. Even in the church, which I think leaves room for the whole notion of worker priests making contributions. A couple more things. As I said at the beginning, vocation, I believe, is tied to your faith and should be rooted in the gospel. And your question is, what is God calling me to do? And I tend to ask that question yearly, at least. Sometimes daily, depending on what's happening over here. But I do ask that question. I feel, for example, that I have been called to teach. And I can do that across a lot of places. So I have enormous possibility if I give myself permission to understand that's what I'm being called to do, and I will do that both in the notion of work, but in my life as a father, and in my life as a member of our church, in my life as a Christian. So, for example, I don't mind paying my way to come to Holman Village to do this because I feel that I'm called to do this, and I'm blessed enough that I can afford to take a couple weeks and do this. In fact, I think it's one of God's greatest gifts to me because I took the time, but I'm learning much more than I anticipated I would learn. See, I came here thinking, I'm here to teach. Yes, and Anthony, to learn something. So, this is a brief overview of where I'm going with this whole notion of vineyards of possibility and vocation and work. And I'm thinking that you really must give some thought and prayer and consideration to what you think your vocation is, or vocations. So, with that in mind, I want to get us into a dialogue. Could five of you be willing to work with me on this? Maybe? Okay. Five people.
In one chair.
No. That chair is open.
I'll try it.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I have this chair or do you want an extra chair?
You can have that chair and I'll bring an extra chair. All right. This is the first question. And we're going to ask a series of questions, and then I'm going to ask you folks in the back there to come up with your own provocative questions about this issue of vocation. But the first question is, have you drank the Kool-Aid, and is it any good? And the way you begin to do this is you don't talk to me, you talk to each other. And our job is to listen. Because we think that you probably have something to tell us about drinking Kool-Aid and feeling good or not good.
I guess I'm not clear as to what that means.
What do you
think? In terms of our careers?
Let me give it a try.
Oh, okay.
Because, I was one who had the fortune of being able to retire early, as Anthony was describing, different ways of ending careers. And I worked for a company that really took care of its people, and it was AT&T. And the company I went to work for is not the same company that. But I drank the Kool-Aid and I really liked it. It was a good company. They gave us lots of freedom. I was in the research firm. And it was fun. But a guy by the name of Judge Green made a decision a few years ago that these people that had been clamoring to get part of that business were right, that competition is the ultimate good in the marketplace, so if we just split it up and make everybody compete, everybody would be better off for it. And business, especially large business, is much better off for it. A whole lot of new business products have been introduced in the market, and people have benefited in that way. The cost of that was that, one is, when I went to work for that company, end-to-end service was its motto. It was sort of like the slogan for the post office. I mean, service they hired good people, and service was really important. I mean, that was why you went to work, why you stayed there. It was, you felt you were serving others. But with that decision, things began to unhinge, and now it's like any other competitive enterprise, and it's a different company. And so I was just lucky. I taste the Kool-Aid, and I really liked it. But I'm glad that I am where I am now. I'm not there. That's, if that's what I think he means by tasting the Kool-Aid, it was, they took care of me, and I trusted them.
If you were starting off your career today, would you drink the Kool-Aid?
It's very hard to say. It's very hard to say. I've changed careers several times, and because of changes in taste, I suppose. I started out in the military, but I decided after my first obligation was up that I would not like that as a lifelong career. Then I went into industry and was doing fine as an engineer, but I decided I would want to teach, so I, at cost to myself, some, and my family especially, I quit my job and went back to get a PhD so I could teach. And when I had finished that, there weren't jobs because I was at the era of Vietnam, and all of the teaching jobs had been picked up by people who didn't want to go to Vietnam. So I had to look at industry, and I was so glad that that turned out that way. I, at that point, I wanted to taste the Kool-Aid.
And go with the program. Did he answer your question?
Yeah, I don't get a sense. Right.
Okay, I'd like to hear from the other four of you in terms of the question, have you drank the Kool-Aid, and is it any good?
I've taken sips of it, and I'm in computers, and I started out as a consultant, then I worked for a company, then I went back to consulting, and now I work now for AT&T, actually. our company was bought by AT&T. I've always struggled. I never anticipated being in business. The bottom, I was in school in the 60s, I was going to be a poli-sci major, and I was going to save the world, of sorts, to be in business, doing computers and technology and so forth. It's very different than what I expected to be. Last summer, I got to the point where the corporate culture was very difficult. There's we always have much too much work to do, and the end goal is to get the projects done. And I felt it at an awful high price as to what it does to the people involved. That's changing a little bit with a little bit different management. So I decided, I came to Holden, I went to quit. They said, well, why don't you think about taking some time off and coming back and working part-time. So I came to Holden for a while and thought about it, and I've gone back working part-time. I'm not sure. I mean, it's interesting coming back here for a week. It's starting to think about it. That's why I was interested about, I still have a ways to go on the path.
Hey, some of the rest of you.
I never have worked for a corporate profit-making organization until my early 50s.
Mm.
And moved into that side of it after spending 20-some years with my wife overseas in various educational sorts of things. And what I did after my last position before I came over, before I left Egypt, was I was the academic dean at the International School in Alexandria, and 6 months later I was doing 18-wheel trucking over the road when I came back to this country. And at this point then, after 4 years of doing that, I decided, well, I really would like to have a more normal life again. So I came into the corporate office, and I have 200 independent truckers and three people working with me that I, or under me, I guess, that I work with. And so the company benefits are pretty good in comparison with that industry. Do I like working in a corporate culture as opposed to working with schools and for a while at church overseas? No, I don't think so. in comparison, even though the benefits are not so bad.
Aren't the church and the schools are just a different flavor of Kool-Aid? Didn't you have some assumption that they were going to take care of you?
No.
Care for you?
No, not really. I didn't, I think I went overseas with the idea of working in different international schools that, although they are organized loosely into some confederations, they're pretty much little independent places. That's in, you know, 5 years in East Africa and 10 years in India, 5 years in Egypt, so.
But they offer no benefits, they couldn't.
Oh, no, I don't say that. I don't say that. But it wasn't that I planned to stay with them for a lifetime.
And what you're pointing out is two different mentalities or mental models in terms of entering into the work contract. I have found companies, for-profit companies, to be sometimes much more paternalistic in their, at least, marketing of the relationship than in some than I have found even in the church, which is kind of an interesting. But what happens is it's a maternalism tied to money. And if that goes away, boy, you probably see this in the new AT&T. More so than you experienced in the old AT&T. But I'd like to hear from the other folks.
I'm a social worker, so I have no desire to be in the corporate world. And to be honest, I don't trust large corporations. I don't trust them to be looking out for individual best interests. So, and I sort of look at I'm young, I know, but I sort of look at work for me as kind of a bunch of projects. I can't imagine being in one job in one agency or company or anything for, I don't know, more than 10 years. I mean, that just seems like forever to me. And who knows, maybe that'll change, but I really do look at things as, you know, work as kind of projects. And when I feel like I've done what I can do, I'm ready to look somewhere else. So that's kind of how I'm looking at things. And we came to Holden last year, and we're leaving in a couple months, and don't know what we're going to do. So Buechner defines vocation as the place where your deep joy meets the world's deep need. And I've been reflecting on that a lot. And I've had one job I worked in an agency for 3 years in Chicago, where that's truly how it felt. I loved it. I was like, this is the greatest thing, this is the greatest place. I feel like I can contribute something. This is joyful for me. And yet I knew I was meeting some needs too, with people, and that's my concern is people. So. Well, interestingly enough, actually I should say, I worked there for 3 years, and the first 2 years were wonderful. And then administration made some really poor decisions and hurt a lot of people. And it's not a very big agency, it's like 60 people or something, you know. But I knew all of them, you know. I mean, I was the social worker for the clients, but I was also the only social worker on staff, so I was pretty much it for everybody and heard everybody's concerns and saw morale just go down the tubes and, you know, tried to, you know, I definitely put more than my 2 cents in about what was going on. But it just became a really unhappy place to be. And I just felt like, you know, I was done all I could for that last year and was beating my head against a wall, and, you know,
it no longer felt joyful.
Exactly.
With the cooler.
And not that, and you know, and that's a tough thing too, because I could bail out. You know, I was working with very low income people, and, you know, that's a whole struggle too. You know, I have the privilege to say, see ya, I'm out of here, I can go do something else. Whereas I know all the people I'm working with and all the clients don't have that option, so that was a real struggle.
With the Kool-Aid metaphor, it was sweet when you started, but it went sour.
Yeah, but I wouldn't, but the Kool-Aid for me, what I was envisioning with the Kool-Aid to be is whether I would invest, whether I would say, I'm here for the long haul, and I don't think that way. I mean, I may be if I feel like my gifts are continuing to be used and I feel good about it and I feel like it's making a difference for people. But I wouldn't, I don't put that much credence in the people I'm working for to say, take care of me, this is what I'm expecting from you. Yes, I want to be taken care of while I'm there. Sure, I'll negotiate my vacation time, which is often more important than them, than my salary to me. And I've done that, you know, I'd say, I'll take a lower salary if I can have more vacation, this is what's
important. So, would it be fair, not to put words in your mouth, would it be fair to say that you've concluded that you can't really count on those folks?
Yeah, and I'm, and that maybe sounds bad. It's because things change, people change, you know. Management changes, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, just like the AT&T thing. You were there in the good years, and maybe you haven't seen it as good as he has. And so it's not that there aren't people out there with good hearts doing good things in management, but that as a person, I'm skeptical. I'm going to make sure that I can take care of myself and not rely for years and years on a pension or something that may be pulled out from me.
I work as a third grade teacher and have for the last 20 years at an Episcopal school in a suburb outside of Seattle. And when I first started 20 years ago, my income was not worth anything, and I didn't even own a car. And there weren't really any benefits to speak of at the time. There were a few. But it didn't matter at my age at that time, I didn't think. I didn't have the foresight to understand the impact of that. And things have improved, obviously, considerably, but in the process, the job has also changed significantly because where it started out as sort of a neighborhood school, it's also situated in Medina, which is a quarter of a mile from where Bill Gates lives, and Microsoft is down the road, and there's just a tremendous amount of wealth in the area that has moved into the school and has changed in many ways what it is we think we're doing. And where we still hold on to the same old values of teaching children to be good people and to contributors to their society and so forth, there's this constant pressure to do it the right way, to meet the expectations of these really very well-to-do families. And my struggle is a personal struggle with, am I really contributing something to teaching the children of the wealthy? And or can I contribute anything? And it takes a tremendous amount of effort. If I don't work 60 hours a week, 9 months of the year, I feel like people are saying,
hey, and if you hold on, yes.
No, I wanted to ask to answer. I wanted to ask another question, yes, in relation to your question. What would the younger people want the retired generation to do? Or what? You know what? What?
It's some of the dialogues I've had with people, because I think the whole notion of family and community is really shifting. It used to be where you were that family that had its boundaries and were secure, and the mom stayed home and the father and all that stuff. Obviously that's changed, and most people don't even live anywhere near within that context. But two things that come up. One is simply listening. My best consultant on parenting is my mother, who raised me and also has a mind that reads and thinks and keeps up on stuff. The other piece is to understand that their people's lives are not the same as your life was. So the best you can do is somehow be a person that offers support. My mother came and when I moved into my other house and helped me get the house ready, because I'm not married, and she knew some stuff and she wanted to come. And those few days of her help, just folding clothes and making sure that I picked out draperies and dealt with the drapery people, it's like, mother, I should just hire you to be my mother. You know? It's like, You know, I was just like, you know, the Sears people are coming today. And she said, honey, I'll take care of it. It was so great as a single person. And I happened to have Katie that summer. So just know that I didn't have to worry about sending Katie to daycare. I had to be home at 5 o'clock. If you live in the same city, my mother does that for my sister. She watches the kids. Mm-hmm. Simple. I think just being a friend and having an ear, because sometimes I don't even want an answer. I just want to call and say, you don't believe what Katie said today. She says she wants to have blonde hair. What should I say? You know, for a child of color, you're like, okay. So there's a role there. And my mother said, Lord, and first she'll say, Lord have mercy, and then the next hour we'll talk. So just for you to know that sometimes that's just what you need. Or I want to be able to call and say, and I've called other people and said, now, how did you explain to your daughter hygiene, the question of hygiene? How does a father do that? And you know, and how do you know if your child has an infection, if she's a girl? You know, I called up a buddy of mine who's divorced with a girl that's about 4 years older than Katie, and he gave me the story. So you can support each other that way. And a lot of times you just want to make sure that you're good parents and tell people that they're being good parents or they're doing the best that they can. The other thing is acknowledge that people are doing the best that they can. I'm going to make a couple more comments and ask one more question, and I think we'll call it for today. But I wanted to, I thought I saw a hand someplace over here, but did someone want to make another comment? Yeah, you can move back. Because he wrote this bizarre book called The Coming of the Cosmic Christ. And it's in our bookstore, and if you care to read it, it will stretch your Lutheran mindset. I had Father Fox as a professor when I was in seminary out on the West Coast with Susan Real. He has written in the area of spirituality. And obviously, when you begin to take a look at vocation, that has some implications regarding spirituality and meaning. And I think it's a pretty good book. I will read a couple things from it that I think will get your mind going. But at the
is that one in the bookstore, Anthony?
No, I've asked them to order it.
But well, they used to have it. They don't have it now?
This book?
Yeah,
no.
It's usually carried.
No, they don't have it. I got here and they didn't have it. But you can get it in most major bookstores. This is his latest book. The Cosmic Christ really is out there in the stratosphere, just for you to know. This is much more down to earth. I don't know if you've read both of them, Professor, but Matthew Fox has a reputation for going where no theologian has gone. What his basic tenet is that we are called to be a part of the great work. He calls the great work the acting out of our sort of faith in the world and ministering to those in the name of God. And the question is, how do you turn your work into some kind of contribution to the great work? And sometimes that may be simply just doing the very best you can, no matter what the task is. Certainly Luther would, I think, agree with that. The two things I want to say about what he has to say is that this is a task that has to sometimes change over the course of your life. And that may have to do with both the quality in which you go about doing your work. When I was young, when I was a teenager, I worked for a man named Woodrow W. Roundtree. And Mr. Roundtree owned the janitorial cleaning service. And this is about 1968, so just kind of notice that time frame. And Mr. Roundtree was from Mississippi and was not an educated man, but I believe he truly was one of the most profound people I've known in my life. And he was profound for a couple reasons. He told me that we came as black people from a fine tradition of doing good work, even if we were cooking food or mopping someone's floor. And today, whenever I mop a floor, I remember to do what he taught me to do with the mop. I think about the way in which he taught me to clean toilets. And he used to say to me, we used to work at this place called the Colgan Electric Company. And he used to take me into the chairman of the office, the company's office there in Toledo, Ohio. He said, Anthony, because he couldn't say Anthony, he'd say, Anthony, boy, I'm going to tell you something. You keep mopping them floors like you're mopping, and one day you're going to have a cushioned office like this white man. Now, that may seem simple, but I kept thinking about that. And so every time I mop and clean my own toilets, I think about doing a good job and finishing my work as almost an expression of my faith. Bringing quality to the most simple task. When I do laundry and I'm frantic, I slow down. I fold the towels slowly. We do have a book in the bookstore called Chop Wood, Carry Water. It's amazing. What? And so what I want to say is that part of the great work is to understand that all work makes a difference. And our job is to bring our faith to the work, much like I started off when I talked about Pillsbury. And knowing when you have to say, enough, I'm done, it's time to move on, it's time for me to do something. The more of us that connect our faith to our vocation and to where we are, in terms of where we act out of work, will basically force a change in the way people are treated. And it's happening with your generation in some ways, because they simply have seen when you drink the Kool-Aid what can happen at the end of the career. So this book I think is really fine. The chapter on economics, but the rest of it is pretty good, and I think will give you some ideas. This book I have found profoundly stimulating, and this is on power. And as you know, work is somehow interconnected with the notion of power. James Hillman, who is a psychologist and has done a lot of work in men's psychology, this is his attempt at dealing with the issue of power. And I want to read a couple things from this book that I think are just enormously illuminating in terms of what we're talking about. He's a psychologist, so understand that he tends to take that point of view, but one of the things I thought that was interesting is he said, the soul is desperately seeking power of mind to be applied to the powerlessness of experience. The soul is desperately seeking the power of mind to be applied to the powerlessness of experiences. Now, I put a question mark in the margin on that one. I think he's half right. I think we're seeking deep faith in order to deal with the powerlessness we experience, whether it be the security question that comes up, or is this all there is and what's going to happen if it all goes away? The second thing that he points out in here that I think was interesting is another quote, is Mussolini made the trains run on time, but at what cost? At what human cost? Of trains ran on time under Mussolini.
My train was 8 hours late.
Is that a good sign?
Well, we made it, I guess.
Good for you. There's just a couple more, and then I'll let you guys go.
Is his last name spelled H-I-L-L-M-A-N?
H-I-L-L-M-A-N, James. Yeah, and it's called Kinds of Power. He says the devotion to efficiency continues unconsciously in the Western psyche, bearing witness to the shadow side of the current living God, the economy. And I think our deepest and...
Say that again.
I'll read it again. The efficiency, the devotion to efficiency continues unconsciously in the Western psyche. We want everything to be quick, as expeditious as possible. You know, that's what we're about. And it bears witness to the shadow side of the current living God, the economy. And his notion is that God is the economy. The new God is economy. And when you really think about it, it certainly takes up a lot of people's mindset. And so the response to that, I'm suggesting, is a continued journey of looking at your faith in relationship to what you're choosing to do. The economy will continue to be out there, and it can change on a dime. You know that as well as I do. And if you put all your eggs in that basket, yes, you may have a wonderful big house and birds and all that great stuff, but in the end, when the economy switches on you, and I always tell people, if you lost everything else, everything today, what would you have? And only you can answer that question. So, I'm recommending that you take a look at this, because it does have a lot to do with power. Also, there's this whole notion of power shift. And I think what you will find is that our entire society, and the U.S. society, is under tremendous pressure to change. And I think that it's going to be a very rocky next 5 years. That's good news. If we were staying stagnant, we'd really be in trouble. The tough part is, it's like white water. You're just not quite, you know, you can't sort of go there in a straight line. So on that note, I want to thank you for coming. And thank you for participating in this dialogue. And may your vineyards have lots of possibilities. See ya.
Thanks.
Thank you.